this is not a quick process. One reason that no investor wanted to invest in Afino was that when I explained to them the invention process, that, well, something you invent today is going to take 7 or 8 years until it gets to the handset in products, and the monetization cycle is so long, no one wanted to invest in this. You need to be ready to wait 5 to 7 years from the day you are inventing until you monetize it. And there's no quick kind of cutting corners or something to make quick money. You have to be this and this for a long haul.
Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. After you're done listening to this episode, don't forget to share it with others and please leave a 5-star rating wherever you're listening now. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by the founder and current CTO of Afino, Ishmael Dainan, and the CEO of Afino, Kewan Lasabzadeh. Kewan was also Afino's first in-house patent attorney. Afino develops, sells, and licenses standard-related technology patents. Good patent attorneys spend a lot of time thinking about how to obtain valuable patents. But, you know, that rarely gets tested in the real world. Even if there's a litigation, it a lot of time gets settled for a lot of different reasons that have nothing to do with, the value or the quality of those individual patents. But you and the team are in the arena of obtaining patents that others find valuable. I'm guessing you have to spend a lot of time thinking about how to do that. So thank you so much for joining Clause 8.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Eli.
So I gave, I guess, a bit quick overview of what Afino is. Maybe, Kewan, can you tell us, what is Afino? Is it what I said? Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, so Afino's changed, I would say, over the years, but we are a research company based in Northern Virginia, and we focus on standard-based technologies. So mostly on the big standards, right? So we have a research team that works on 5G, soon to be 6G research. We have another team working on Wi-Fi, which is an IEEE-based standard. And we have a video compression group that is working on various different standards in the MPEG arena.
Before we get to the beginning, I'm curious, you know, obviously we're talking to both of you. And as I mentioned, Kewan was the first patent attorney that was hired by Afino. Ishmael, can you tell us, what's the pitch that you gave him to convince him to join?
The pitch was really that he's going to work directly with the inventors. And that's I think it's very valuable for both inventors and patent attorneys. My experience to be an inventor in the past was, prior to starting Afino, was that I would meet with the patent attorney only 1 hour during the entire patent prosecution process to explain the invention, and that was it. But in Afino, attorneys and inventors, they basically work in the same office next to each other, and there are lots of interactions between inventors and attorneys, and that's what's really my pitch. I'm not sure how much I convinced Kewan, but yeah, he joined at the end. I was a bit surprised, but he did. I mean, I was working with patent attorneys before in Afino as contractors, but he was really the first full-time employee, patent attorney employee that we hired.
So, Kewan, you came from a big IP firm. Why did you join Afino? Is it for those reasons? And what was your vision for it, when you first joined?
Working in a larger patent prosecution firm, I was at Stern Kessler in Washington, D.C. for over 10 years. And, you know, I was really looking for a change of pace, so to say. At a law firm, you're more of a generalist, I would say. And going in-house, focusing on, very specific technologies, that was enticing to me. And, after meeting with Ishmael during the interview, I was pretty much convinced, within the first 10 minutes of talking to Ishmael that, this company was going somewhere. Ishmael kind of laid out the vision for the company, kind of where it was and where he saw it moving towards in the future. And, the space that Ishmael was working in on the 5G side, I mean, I knew there's tremendous potential in that area. Obviously, there's difficulties in working in any space when you're talking about patents. There's a lot of lot of issues, but I thought the industry was right, and I thought Ishmael was the right person to really push that company forward from where it was. So,
Ishmael, you kind of mentioned that you used to be an engineer, work with patent attorneys, but how did the idea for Afino came about, and what was your initial vision of how Afino would make money?
Yeah, the idea came about based on my prior experiences in other companies. I was a prolific inventor before joining Afino. So I was quite familiar with the patent process. I was a patent agent and a prolific inventor. And what really, I was so, because I was working with a lot of patent attorneys, and really the reason I took the patent bar exam was I was so curious on how they convert my ideas to a patent application. It was a puzzle for me, like, why do they write claims? Why do they write it like this? Then I self-educated myself by reading books and, did a lot of patent bar questions and passed the patent bar. And the inefficiency in the current system really was astounding. Like, we see, like, the inventors have no clue about what is a patent, what is the patent process, why do they invent, what is really a good patent, what is a bad patent, which inventions are more valuable. They had no clue. And on the other hand, the patent attorneys that I worked with, they had little appreciation about the details of the technology. And the technology, the 5G technology, is so sophisticated that the patent attorneys, they can't learn about the entire system and the details. And I felt like the system is broken and inefficient, and especially for getting standard essential patents. You have to have an optimized process from beginning to end, and that at least didn't exist in the companies that I worked for. And I said, okay, I can build a system that makes this system more efficient, at least like 10, 20, 30 times. So why not? You know, like, I said, okay, like, I'm going to start my own company, do R&D. And initially I prosecuted all of my patents myself for about 3 years before I worked with patent attorneys.
And did you draft?
I drafted the patent applications. I was my own paralegal. I was filing them. I was going to patent office for every single application to interview with the examiner at that time. I would do in-person interview in the patent office. And I was doing my claim charts myself.
And this was around
2011. Yeah, 2011. At that time, everything was in person. Then I messed up a lot until I really learned. And I learned a lot from patent attorneys like Kayvon after I started working with them. And it's a quite complicated process from beginning to end. If you want to get it right, you have to pay attention to lots of details.
From what I hear, you quit your job and you said, you know, I'm going to come up with new innovations and get the patents on my own. What was your goal? What are you going to do with these patents? What was your, like, initial plan to monetize?
I didn't have much idea. I knew that the patents are valuable if they're standard essential, but I didn't have much experience on monetization. That was the weak point of Afino, because I had no idea. I made a lot of mistakes in the monetization process until I learned it. I didn't know much. And I didn't have much appreciation how difficult the monetization part was. But with the help of patent brokers and patent attorneys, I was able to monetize after. It took me 5 years. You know? So I worked in the basement all alone for 5 years before I started kind of really hiring other employees. It took a long time to monetize my first invention.
And, you know, a lot of inventors kind of face those issues. I mean, how did you find that first broker?
That's when I also, it didn't go well. I found the first broker that promised me a lot of things but couldn't really sell anything. So it took about a year and like hundreds of calls, but we weren't able to sell anything to anyone. And I hired another broker. I terminated that brokerage agreement. I hired a second broker. He was able to sell some of the patents, but it took a long time. It took about 2 years to sell my first patents. Yeah. So you have to be patient. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I guess did that ever time you doubt, well, maybe there isn't a market for these patents?
Yeah, I almost quit. You know, like, it was a year, four and a half, that I I started really stopped inventing and started doing consulting because I was going out of cash. Cash flow was negative. I spent all my savings. And I remember I was in San Francisco and working as an expert witness for a jury trial just to make money because I needed to, you know, fund my activities. That my broker called me and said, hey, Huawei is interested to purchase the patent you have on mobile payments. And that was an exciting moment.
Yeah, that's an amazing story that you stuck through that. I'm sure Keon has a different perspective, but, you know, attorneys always find a way to make money, right? But, you know, one of the things about being patent attorneys, you hear about, you know, it's pretty hard to monetize or enforce a patent because some of the, you know, of the way the patent system is today. You know, Keon, when you were joining the company, did that worry you? Did that worry you that, you know, maybe there's some licensing by these big patent holders, but is anybody going to pay attention to what a smaller player is doing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's always a concern, especially, you know, it was after 2013, you know, AIA was already in play. And, you know, working at Stern Kessler, I was involved in a lot of IPRs and understanding the whole process and the devaluation of patents around that time. So, but one thing, you know, to be fair to Ishmael and to the company in general, at the time I joined, there was already established revenue coming into the company, right? I mean, it wasn't where we are today, but it was there. So it wasn't so much of a leap for me at that point to prove out the model that it would work. So yeah, there was a little bit of faith on my part, but it wasn't to a large extent. You know, the model was proven to some extent at that point.
Ishmael, you mentioned that patent attorneys don't always know what engineers do and how they come up with these inventions. I was hoping maybe you could give some insight into that. So, you know, from an outsider's perspective, you know, there's these standard setting bodies and all these companies that are involved in that kind of get together and decide, you know, this is going to be part of a 5G standard or not, improve that. But can you tell us, how does that actually work? How do you figure out, well, this is a new innovation for 5G. How does an idea like that come to you? You then decide to obtain a patent.
You're working on standardized technologies make the invention process a bit easier, but not a lot easier because standards, they have roadmaps, the five-year roadmap that, like for 5G, even now they're discussing about the requirements for 6G. It's very ambitious requirements. The technical specification is not defined. But you know what is needed at the end. So then we look at the existing technologies and we identify the gaps. I mean, first we need to define, you know, like 6G by itself is a conglomerate of 20 different technologies. So we look at each of them. So and then we look at the gaps between the existing technologies and where it needs to get in like 5-6 years. And we identify issues. And we come up with algorithms, solutions. I don't know, did that answer your question?
No, I think it does. I guess, you know, one question that I have, and maybe I'm too deep in the weeds, but you said, you know, there's some goals with this 5G or the next standard, and there's all these problems that I'm guessing you recognize that, you know, that you want to solve and improve, but there's so many ways of solving these problems, but, you know, only one of them is going to end up in the standard, right? And sometimes not even the best one. Or maybe I'm wrong about the way I'm thinking about it. I guess, how do you figure out like where this is a good innovation for the standard, this is kind of will be kind of embraced by the other players in the field?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You're actually thinking exactly the right way. And no one has crystal ball to determine like what solution will be adopted by the standard, right? So what we can do is that we can identify problems before other companies, but that's one of the things that we're really good at. We identify problems that exist in the current standard, and then we have like 25 PhDs now working on 5G. So all these inventors discuss with each other, and they come up with different solutions. Like we don't come up with like one solution for the problem. We identify the problem, we come with a five, six, seven different ways of solving that problem. And then we discuss and we improve each of these solutions. And the patent applications that we have include all these solutions in a single patent. And even with that exercise, we don't get it right. You know, standard sometimes comes up with the solutions that we haven't thought about, or maybe those solutions are better. So that's really the challenge. Like, for example, let's say satellite communications. So in 5G, they decided that the handsets should communicate with satellite transceivers. And so we know that the communication with satellites has challenges because of propagation delay. Like the delay, propagation delay is much larger than what was the requirement before for physical layer, MAC layer of 5G standards. So introducing that much delay will create lots of disturbances in how physical layer of 5G works. We identify those issues, and then we come up with creative solutions to those issues, and we try to cover as many solutions as possible. And even with that, we don't know. You know, a lot of times, actually, the majority of the times, we don't get it right. And that's just a part of doing business, is just the risk in inventions. You know, you invent, but most of the inventions go obsolete in a couple of years. You know? And that's just how it is. You know?
So, and maybe this is a somewhat cynical perspective, but there's a perspective out there that the standards are, you know, all these companies involved just lobby for whatever their own inventions are because they want to benefit from it. I mean, from your perspective, do the standards organizations, are they on the search for the best solution out there, no matter who it came from? And is that part of a reason why Athena can succeed? That even though, you know, you might not have you're not the 300-pound gorilla in those rooms, if yours is the best idea or you have the best idea that you'll...
I mean, standards are like democracies. And they're politics, but you can't really convince people if your ideas are completely wrong. You know, like, so if you identify a solution and to a true problem and the solution is good, people have to reject that idea in the standard organization if they have a convincing reason. So I really believe that, I am impressed how efficient standard organizations are. There are politics involved, and sometimes companies lobby for their ideas, but that's part of the standard process. That's a part of democracy. But the intention is to have a technology at the end that is efficient, is the most efficient possible. And all the member companies, not all, I mean, majority of member companies, big companies, small companies, they have that intention in mind.
And it is the engineers there, and as you were one who kind of have that vision, who want the best technology out there, right? That's what they're thinking about.
So that's what they're thinking about,
that's important to remember, yeah. So I want to go back to that first, your first experience with trying to sell your patents. From the broker's perspective and the buyer's perspective, what were they looking at as far as you could tell, and what did you learn from that experience about obtaining patents?
Well, what I learned from the experience is, now, if you want to sell the patent, you need to have a good patent. A good patent means that you need to have a clear strategy in mind from the day the invention starts. So why are you inventing? What is your target? What is your target product? And then the quality is the most important thing. After AIA, people are concerned about the prior art, whether your patent is valid or not. So you need to address all the questions that will come up later. At the beginning, you can't solve these problems after the fact. So you need to do an extensive prior art search, submit everything to the patent office. You need to have solid claim charts. You need to have really a good quality spec and claims. And so the quality trumps everything. If you want to stand out and sell a patent, you need to have a quality patent. And then your claim charts and your prosecution history speak, and the patent specification speaks for itself. Put it in front of companies, and they're very diligent in how they analyze the patents and determine the value, I would say.
From what I understand, you know, they're scrutinizing. Once you get the patent, they're scrutinizing if it's valid, if there's infringement. Maybe infringement is the wrong word. If it reads on what's out there, And that obviously you have a kind of a best practices were used in terms of drafting and obtaining that patent. So that's interesting how all of that comes into play. You saw those first patents. Were you thinking about, should I be licensing or selling them in the beginning? Or did you just decide that maybe selling is the easier
move? Selling was the easier move, especially that with my background. I didn't have much of experience in licensing. And it was a difficult journey to license patents for me. So I went to an easier option. Now, like, we have a lot of resources. Kayvon is on board. And he has a lot of ideas on licensing. You can talk about it quite a bit. We're a different company. But at that time, I was my strengths were on inventions. It wasn't on monetization. Really. Yeah.
There's a lot of inventors out there who think they have patents that are worth something. And you obviously went through one bad experience with one broker, and then you didn't give up, went to another broker. Any advice about finding that right broker or somebody who can meaningfully help you through that process?
Ask about the prior transaction. Interview multiple brokers. Don't just go with the broker that promises the most and the first broker that you met. And ask a lot about the number of transactions that make a year, examples of previous transactions. And it's like a job interview. You really interview multiple brokers and pick the one that you feel most comfortable with.
Ishmael hinted at it, and I think you said it yourself, that the company kind of changed since you joined, Kayvon. Can you tell us about that evolution? How is it different today than where it was, besides the different technology areas?
Yeah, so when I joined, the company was obviously much smaller at the time. It was about 6 years ago. I believe we were under 10 people, around 10 people at the time. Now we're close to 70, 75 people right now at the company. It's hard to keep up with, you know, all the new faces you see. So I think one of the changes really that took place since I've joined is just the ability to scale the model, right? So Ishmael put in place a model that worked very effectively for the size of the company, right? Everyone was able to get into the same room together, kind of learn the principles of how the company operated. But as we scaled and got bigger and bigger, it got harder for everyone to be in the same room, right? To get on the same page and to make sure that we had a process in place to ensure that, you know, we're creating these valid standard essential patents, which really is the goal of what we do at Afino, right? To do quality research and then make sure that we have the patents to back it up. So scaling that the model that Ishmael put in place from the beginning, you know, with his original idea, having seen the problem in the industry, that's kind of really where I think, you know, I've played a role in helping Ishmael since I've joined.
Is there any company that you look out there and kind of see as a model for what you're doing or inspired by what they've done in the patent space?
Yeah, it's tough. I think we kind of pride ourselves on being different in how we do things. I think efficiency is one of the things that we really pride ourselves on, right? Having an efficient process in place to not just generate a whole stack of patents, right? But quality patents, right? Again, our goal is not just to kind of generate 1,000 patents and hope that 50 of them are essential, right? So when you look at other companies, they do have processes in place, but we think the process we put in place and refined over these years has led to not an optimal, but you know, as close as possible to being the most efficient in terms of generating the highest percentage of valid standard essential patents. And a lot of it has to deal with what Ishmael said, involving patent attorneys on the technical side and training them, right? Eli, being, I know you're outside counsel, you know, and me previously being at a law firm, you're more of a generalist, right? There, you can't really focus on any one specific technology. You're kind of bouncing around from client to client. I mean, my time at Stern Kessler, I was working on Christmas tree technology, right, one day, and then working on, you know, transceiver technology the other day. So at Afino, we can train our patent attorneys. We have almost 15 patent attorneys in house now here at Afino, and we're able to really get them steeped into the technology. And on the flip side, the inventors are really becoming involved, and we train them on patent law. So both teams are really versed in each other's space, and the interaction between them is something that's controlled to a high degree based on the process we put in place here at Afino.
So I really want to dig into that a bit. But before, I guess I want to talk a little bit about the business model. In the beginning, Afino sold patents and you sell patents to operating companies. And Ishmael described in the beginning why some of these operating companies might have issues with obtaining these type of patents on their own. But why are they interested in acquiring them? What kind of drives that? Can you give us some sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know all the details about why they're acquiring these assets. You know, obviously, there's a couple big reasons that kind of stick out that are kind of obvious. For one, being cross-licensing reasons, right? A lot of these companies that are purchasing assets from us are involved in cross-licensing negotiations, and having more SEPs of their own obviously would reduce their royalty burden. So that's probably the primary reason a lot of these operating companies are looking to acquire assets from us. But I mean, in general, I think even companies that are working in the same space that have groups, you know, technologists and engineers working in the same area, they're acquiring assets from us because SEPs are hard to generate, right? They just don't happen by accident. And you really have to have a methodical approach to generating these assets. And I think we can do it very efficiently, and we can obviously provide these assets to these companies looking for them.
One of the big transactions that has been reported is Honda buying patents from you all. You know, we'll talk about it in a bit, but the Vanshi, right? It's this new platform where basically, I think the goal is for car companies not to have to worry about this patent. They just pay some like fixed fee to license all these patents. Does that make you think differently about what your business model is in terms of, will these operating companies really be the purchasers of patents in the future, or is Avanci really the future?
I think patent pools have a place in the industry, right? So Avanci is a patent pool. I think it's a very successful patent pool. So they're focused, at least one of their focuses in the pool we joined is their 5G automobile platform. They call them a platform now, I think, not pools. And, you know, they have 80%, over 80% of the market in terms of the patents in their 5G patent pool. And they have all the big players. So, you know, we were glad to join Avanci. It's a source of revenue for Afino. It just started. The program just started. So it's going to be a future source of revenue for the company. So, you know, whenever there's different areas and that we can generate reliable, consistent revenue, we're always going to look towards those areas.
But does that make you think differently about whether operating companies will still be as interested in acquiring patents? Do you think that will change?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to change to a large extent. There's pools play one role in the industry, and I don't think they solve all the problems. And so I still think operating companies will be interested in acquiring SEPs for various reasons.
Ishmael mentioned that, you know, in the beginning he was selling patents, and then when you joined, you kind of broadened the ideas about what Afino could do, and Avanci is one example of that. Can you give us a sense, how does Avanci evaluate your patents? You know, how do they evaluate what share you'll get of the royalties they'll collect, or what contribution you're making? Is it same thing as it when you're selling patents, or is it different in any way?
Yeah, so generally most patent pools work on a point system, right? So you get a certain number of points based on the number of standard essential patents you have and that have been evaluated by the pool. And revenues are generally split proportionally, or to some extent proportionally, based on, you know, your share of essential patents that you're contributing to the pool. So that's the general mechanism in terms of...
That's interesting about the evaluation process, obviously. Is it kind of like they randomly pick out patents out of your portfolio? Or?
Yeah, so they don't do a random. So it's effectively you have to submit claim charts, right? You have to show that your patents, you know, read on the standard. So you submit claim charts for your patents that you, you know, are claiming to be standard essential. And then they have a third-party evaluator evaluate your claim, right? They go through the claim chart and make an independent evaluation of essentiality. And then based on the outcome of that evaluation, you would get, you know, a certain number of points, and those points get totaled and revenue gets distributed proportionally. And there's other considerations that these pools take into account when they're considering revenue. It's not just the proportion of SEPs that you have. Some other pools have various other considerations like contributions and licensing revenue, etc.
Do you think differently about what patents are valuable for licensing or a platform like Avanci versus patents that you would sell, or in terms of obtaining the actual assets, is there anything that you think maybe focus on one more thing than the other? Does essentiality become a bigger kind of a bigger issue than validity, and for example, or anything like that that you kind of think about? Or should you be filing more patents, splitting up the innovations into different patents, in any stuff like that that kind of makes you think differently?
Yeah, in terms of like validity versus essentiality, you know, here at Afino, again, quality is a huge point of emphasis here. So we do care about both to a large extent, validity and essentiality. And, you know, internally, we have our own quality processes in place to kind of check for both of those, right, throughout the patent process. So that doesn't change.
Well, one thing to add is, like, the companies who purchase our patents, many of them, they purchase it to join the pool themselves, or they're already a member of the pool. So, and, or they purchase the patents to license. And so I don't see any difference between, like, quality of the patents in terms of, or types of patents in terms of selling or licensing or joining pools. There are, like, at the end of the day, companies, they want to monetize patents. But one point with the patent pool is that they, the existing pools are all focused on the handsets and the devices and devices. So that makes patents that are applicable to end devices more valuable for pools like Avanci and or Cisco patent pools. They're all focused around the end devices. So we tend to focus on drafting claims for end devices for all our patents.
So that's interesting. Maybe the what you cover might think about that. But what I'm trying to get at is, you know, there's a lot of ways to protect a technology in a patent, right? You can file this one patent application with 600 ideas and then, you know, file continuations for it for, you know, the next 10 years. Or you can file, you know, very discrete patents. Like I said, maybe you focus on one thing over the other, but correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that you don't really think about it differently, aside from what Ishmael mentioned, but you don't think about it differently in terms of how to obtain those patents.
By the time we draft the patents, we don't know if it's for sale, licensing, pools. We don't even know that. And you know, we have a process to split inventions in different patents. We say like one feature in the standard, you know, one problem, and all the solutions to that problem is one patent. So that's how we identify on how to divide ideas into multiple patents. And that, at the point of invention, we don't have different processes because it's too early to determine where this patent is going to end up. We just don't know. It's going to be even a valuable patent or will be a worthless patent. We just don't know at the time of invention, really.
This is not about Afino, but I had Tim Pullman on the podcast of IPlytics. And they ran into some controversy because they ranked the biggest SCP holders or whatever. And you know, some of the SCP holders made a good point saying, well, just because they have the most number of patents doesn't mean they contributed the most to the technology, right? Is that a problem, that correlating an inventor's contribution versus some of these points or anything else? Is that a problem?
Our objective is different from other companies because the number of patents and count, it's important for them. But for us, when companies that buy patents from us, they look at every single patent and pick the ones that they want. So if we have a large portfolio, it doesn't help us to sell more. We need to look at every single invention. Okay, can we sell this invention to another company? Is it a valuable patent or not? At the end of the day, it counts. You know, the companies who do business with us, they don't care if you have 100 patents or 5,000 patents. The question is, Samsung comes and purchases patents from us if they can find 10 good patents in our portfolio. And they really go through the entire portfolio to find those 10. And so the count doesn't matter for us. But for other large organizations, the ranking in terms of number of patents and where they end up in the charts and the IPlytics database, and they all play a role for them. But for us, is different. I don't know. So they may play the game to get to higher and higher numbers and file a lot of patents and then rank, categorize their patents as, okay, these are just for us to get to a larger number, but these patents are really good patents. We're going to focus on those. But for us, it's different because every single patent is either it's a positive cash flow or a negative cash flow. If it, we can make money from it, it, that means that it's a good investment. If we can't make money from that single patent, it's a waste of money.
The way you view it is each one of your patents, if it's going to be positive cash flow, is going to be scrutinized on its own. It's not going to be a basket of, well, here's 1,000 patents.
No one purchased patents from us like that. Companies is different. The industry changed from 20 years ago when large portfolios were transacted. Now it's done like that. You don't see large transactions in terms of between operating companies. It's more of its small targeted transactions. The companies come in, they look at the portfolio, they pick patents that they like, and then they pay for it.
Keon, you mentioned that before you joined Ofino, you worked for a lot of different technologies. You worked on IPRs after AIA. So I'm sure all of that gave you perspective. Is there anything else that I guess you kind of thought about how things should be different, apart from just working closely with inventors? Anything else was on top of your mind?
The one other big thing that after joining Ofino, or while joining Ofino, was that, you know, when we're drafting patents as outside counsel for a lot of these bigger companies, you're really focused on the inventor's invention at that time. But here at Ofino, you know, we have sort of a moving target with the standard, right? So we're not just trying to prosecute a patent that covers one solid idea that the inventor proposed at the beginning, right? We're trying to follow and track the standard and trying to amend the claims, not only to avoid the prior art during prosecution, but also to continue reading on the standard and to evolve with the standard. So I think that's one of the bigger things after joining Ofino.
You know, Ishmael, you mentioned that before, and I think I referenced this, is that you'd get a 1 hour with an attorney and they draft the application and go from there. I mean, you said you had contractors in the beginning and then you brought on Keon. How did you make the decision about building a big team in-house? Did you consider saying, like, I want to have them at a law firm, but they all need to be focused on my stuff? How did you think about that?
Like, I had over 100 patents before joining up, 100 inventions. And I've never, no one sent me a single office action. I didn't know, like, office actions exist. I've never been on examiner's interviews as an inventor. I've never, like, no one really talked to me about, like, the way I drafted disclosure, was it good or bad, or how they can enhance it. I didn't learn anything from attorneys directly when I invented in the past. But I wanted the inventors here, more than the attorneys, to learn from attorneys on how to invent, how they need to think about the inventions and drafting a patent application. And also attorneys, I wanted them to learn from the inventors. So this dynamic between patent attorneys and inventors was the core part of my original idea. So I didn't have a good experience, I would say, working with outside law firm because of the dynamics that existed. You know, later on I talked to patent attorneys, they said that they had no other choice because, you know, they're under billable hours and the clients, you know, they want to pay that much. It's not like anybody's fault. The patent attorneys are smart. I mean, the inventors are smart, but the system is built in a way that dynamic is not a part of the whole process. And that was my original idea. I wanted to create that dynamic within one company. Yeah.
So I'm kind of interested to go through, I think you've kind of hinted at it, about this close working relationship that engineers and patent attorneys have. On a practical level, how that works, we discussed an inventor might come up with a idea. What happens next in terms of, what does that inventor do? How does he get the patent attorney involved? Can you give us a sense of that?
The initial discussions are typically among the inventors until they get to a point that, okay, this problem and these solutions are qualified to be kind of considered by the legal team. And then before drafting the patent application, the discussion starts. The patent attorney provides feedback on all the drawings, on the disclosure. The amenders goes back and revisit everything they had. And from the point that, from that point, really, there are lots of integration between the patent attorneys and the inventors. And the claims are drafted together. The inventor, patent attorney, they're in the same room. They draft the claims together. And so the whole drafting process is done together between the patent attorney and the inventor. The inventor writes something, sends it to the patent attorney, gets feedback, and then until the specification is ready for filing. And for claim charges, the same thing. You know, there's so much interaction between the two. When we get an office action, the inventor receives it. On all examiner's interview, the inventor is present. And the whole process from the beginning to the end, there's so much integration that I haven't seen any other companies having even a similar process.
Do you track, let's say, how long does it take for us to prepare a patent application?
We don't track it. We don't track it at all. We don't track the number of hours you spend on a case. I mean, I tell attorneys, like, spend as much time you need it. We don't have, like, an hour tracking system, nothing. We're like a research lab. You don't have to worry about time. Focus on quality and spend as much time as needed on every case.
I think one thing we learned, too, over the years is that the inventor's time is very valuable, right? So we're not trying to just use their time like 100% on patent prosecution and, you know, obtaining these patents, right? We have to be very kind of smart in terms of how we use their time, because their time is obviously more valuable coming up with new inventions and solving problems in the standard. So, and that's especially true in if you go outside the 3GPP area into video compression. Those experts are really doing a lot of programming and testing. It takes a lot of their time, right? So we have to be very smart in terms of how we use their time in that patent process.
I think you make a very good point, because back in the day, there was an interesting article, but I think it was the chief IP counsel of Cantor Fitzgerald at the time. And he said, you know, for most tech companies, the most valuable commodity they have is their engineers' time. And they actually want their patent attorneys to bother them as little as possible. For you, the app and patents are what's most important. What have you discovered that, where do they make the biggest contribution to the obtaining the high quality patents? Where is their input most valuable, or they're able to provide input above and beyond what in a normal process, maybe that Ishmael experienced before?
I think one of the biggest areas we see is helping in the drafting process. Being very involved in that, because not only do they add additional embodiments to the specification, clarify embodiments, they also come up with new ideas. And Ishmael always talks about this, that inventors, when they're involved in the drafting process and helping to draft some of the applications, it helps them to think through their idea further. And they come up with additional embodiments at that point in time. So I think that's one area it's a very good use of the inventor's time. Claim drafting is another area. Having them involved in claim drafting, having them understand the claims is very important.
What do you mean by involved in claim drafting? In that they scrutinize the drafted claims, or do they draft the claims themselves?
Both. We have inventors who are very skilled at claim drafting. Some inventors here have probably drafted more claims than myself at this point. Just because they're such prolific inventors and they're working on a lot of their own claim sets. But having them understand claim terminology, claim language, really helps with the prosecution process down the road, right? When you get an office action, they understand the nuances of what's in the claim and what's not in the claim, right? Arguing differences in the claim and not things that aren't in the claim. And then just updating the claims when the standard evolves or when the standard changes, or based on prior art that comes up during the prosecution process. So that involvement and that level of knowledge on the inventor's parts in terms of the patent process has been very important.
I think claim drafting is one of the important part of the process that both attorney and inventor, they have to work together, because attorneys are taught to write the broadest possible valid claim. But how could you write the broadest possible valid claim if you don't know about the extent of the prior art? Because prior art technologies are so sophisticated. There are like thousands of, tens of thousands of documents and literature out there that a PhD with 20 years of experience has everything in his head, you know, like at least the majority of it. So when the attorneys are after, they try to broaden the claim, the mentor can always provide feedback. Okay, now you're getting to kind of gray area. This is not valid. This is too broad. Reads that on that technology, maybe on similar technology. So when they work together, they can write really good claims. I mean, the mentors can't do it by themselves. The attorneys can't do it by themselves. But they together, they can write the best claims.
No, that's a good point. Sometimes if you broaden a five claim supposed to cover 5G, you might end up something goes in there for 3G, right? So
yeah, that's true, yeah. Some of the terms are important, some are not, yeah.
You created this new model at Afino. Now, Ishmael, I want to go back to you to kind of ask, do you think an operating company can replicate what you're doing? Could you go back to one of your companies that you worked for and say, we will have this team that is going to be focused on obtaining high-quality patents? Do you think what you're doing can happen?
They can't do it because it requires so much change in the way they operate that it's just, it's like changing the direction of a large, huge boat or a dinosaur. You know, like it's just hard to introduce so much change into the system. The incentives are designed improperly, and it's just not possible. I can't envision that. They can make some improvements. That's possible. Maybe I would rephrase it. It would take a long time to do that because you can't introduce that much change instantly, but they can start by making incremental changes that are easier and over a long time get to where we are. You know, that's possible. Start training their mentors and just slowly changing the process. Sort
of. Because you mentioned Samsung, you know, an idea that just came up to my head. Samsung gets a lot of patents, and I'm guessing maybe they're not as good as the Afino patents. Samsung might say, well, let me just buy Afino for a few billion dollars, and, you know, we'll have our own team focused within on obtaining those high-quality patents, but to be like an independent entity. Do you think something like that could work, where you have like an independent group within a company that just obtaining patents?
Yeah, it's what large companies do. They acquire smaller, more efficient companies to grow. And that's a possibility sometimes in the future. We have been approached by those kind of ideas. We haven't done that because I think we're at a kind of rapid growth mode now. It's just not the right time. I think we can prove a lot more value to the industry before that happens. So that's why we're taking our time.
Makes sense. Kayvon, you mentioned when I asked you a chance to describe what Afino is, you really focused on the research and the development piece of it. You know, there might be somebody listening to this, a cynic might say that, you know, what they're doing is they're kind of just taking advantage of the way the standard essential patent system works. They're trying to get some patents to cover stuff that's going to be in the standard and trying to make money off that. Is there any truth to that? And then can you explain if that's not the case? I mean, what is the role that Afino plays in terms of helping innovation that your inventors come up with actually ending up in the smartphone or in a car out there? How does that kind of work?
Yeah, I mean, you could just look at our customer base, right? We work with, I mean, I don't know how many different innovative operating companies. They're looking to us to acquire, you know, these standard essential patents that they need to continue their business, right? To continue innovating in their space. So we're playing a role in the industry if you just look at who we're working with on the patent sales side. And I can tell you one thing. I mean, we on our video compression side, for example, you know, we just invested in a cluster, our own private cluster. You know, that was a huge expense. Our inventors are improving, you know, the current standard, which is, you know, they're working right now on the standard beyond VVC, which is something called enhanced compression beyond VVC. And, you know, we just had one contribution that we made, I think it was about three months ago, that improved the compression gain by over 1% from one of our inventors, right? And that the amount of research involved in that was extensive. I mean, it was very extensive. And at the time we were using actually cloud services. We spent over, you know, I could share this. We spent over $500,000 simulating the tests needed to prove that concept and get it introduced into the standard and hopefully very soon implemented in devices. So I would say it's just not the case, right? Afino is contributing. Our inventors are, you know, experts in the field, and we see our contribution in many different forms.
Putting Afino to the side for a second, if you could do that, are there any flaws that you see in the way kind of a standard central patents system works, or maybe there aren't, or I think Ishmael said it works pretty well.
Yeah, nothing's perfect, obviously. There's always going to be inefficiencies in the system, and, you know, there's a reason why I think there's, you know, legislation in Europe right now being introduced. Whether it's good or bad, there's a lot of inefficiencies, right? And I think that legislation's aimed at improving on those inefficiencies. I think transparency is an issue in this industry in general. There's obviously room for improvement, and no system is perfect.
And you mean transparency in terms of pricing or
pricing? Yeah, all sorts of transparency, pricing included.
Okay. For the record, there is a lot of controversy about this.
Yes.
Proposals, whether they're good or bad. A lot of people, I guess, who are in the innovation business are not happy with those proposals, but that's, I guess we'll see what happens with that. I'm sure some people are going to be listening to this and they're going to be like, wow, that's a great idea. They proved it can work. I should do that. Maybe an engineer. I mean, what advice would you give them? Ishmael, if you want to tackle that first.
Well, we had people who left Afino to start a similar business. So I would say that... when you look at it from outside, you see, oh, you're generating mentions and patents and you're selling them. I can do the same thing. If you want to do the same thing, my advice is focus on quality. Like, people who purchase patents are concerned about prior art. They're concerned about the quality of your claim, the quality of the specification, the quality of your claim charts. Think about all those from the beginning. You know, do all, an extensive prior art search, submit everything to patent offices. And if you don't know how to prosecute, get really good prosecution attorneys that you can work with. And then the other advice I have, this is not a quick process. One reason that no investor wanted to invest in Afino was that when I explained to them the invention process, that, well, something you invent today is going to take 7 or 8 years until it gets to the handset in products. And the monetization cycle is so long, no one wanted to invest in this. You need to be ready to wait 5 to 7 years from the day you are inventing until you monetize it. And there's no quick kind of cutting corners or something to make quick money. You have to be this for a long haul and be ready for it, you know, so.
No, that's great advice. I think a theme is there's no shortcuts to obtaining. You need to invest in the innovation, invest in obtaining high-quality patents, and then kind of invest in waiting that out. Kayvon, you have a little bit of an outside perspective. Is there anything about what qualities does an engineer need to have, make a go of this and be successful, or maybe even a patent attorney out there who thinks they're an engineer?
Yeah, I think Ishmael touched on the big points. I think the monetization timeline is extremely long, right? And that's something you have to be aware of when you try to set out on your own. Also, inventing, you know, in a vacuum without other inventors to kind of bounce ideas off of, especially initially early on in this company that you're trying to find, establish, it's difficult, right? Our inventors are constantly in rooms together, having offline idea discussions, online idea discussions. And without that constant interaction, it's very hard to kind of refine the idea and get the idea right to begin with. So that's probably my two points on that side.
Very interesting. What I want to kind of end with is people will be hearing it, will kind of get a sense of this. It seems like you have a very great relationship. Obviously, Kayvon joined as a first full-time patent attorney. Now he's the CEO. And Ishmael talked about how he's contributed. I mean, can you, Ishmael, starting with you, can you talk a little bit about why did you step aside to allow Kayvon to be the CEO and think about whether a patent attorney can do that or not? And
That didn't happen overnight. So like Kayvon was with us over 6 years, and you observed the decisions. I observed the decision that he made, and how he carried out and executed tasks over time. He was a senior patent attorney, then became director of 5G portfolio, and then became chief IP counsel, and then became CEO. So it was a process, give assignments. Well, it's just like he can do better than me. Why not? I'm not afraid of delegating if I find the right person. But I'm really strong in inventing and analyzing the technologies, and in other areas. I was gifted to find really people that are more qualified than I am, and I can trust them. So I just delegated. That was kind of, if you work with Kayvon, you would see that this is a no-brainer to make that decision. He's so good.
Before Kayvon's head gets too big, I guess the question for him is that there's probably maybe a Stern Kessler attorney sitting there who's been there for 10 years, and he goes, wow, Kayvon found a really cool opportunity, and he succeeded at it. I guess, can you give some advice to that attorney sitting there thinking about how do you find an opportunity like this? How do you succeed outside the structure of a law firm?
Yeah, so in-house is different from a law firm setting, right? It's a different skill set when you're moving up in terms of a leadership role, right? I mean, there's partners in law firms, and they obviously play an important role in terms of leadership. But really, it's a growth mentality. You have to always be looking to grow your skill set, right? And a leadership position has a different skill set than a patent attorney, right? Who's drafting applications and prosecuting applications. And so you have to have a willingness to constantly learn and grow in terms of that skill set. But one thing working with Ishmael, Ishmael has been great as a mentor in that space. And I've taken a lot of, my experiences from working with Ishmael closely over these past 6 years. So having a mentor is also very important in succeeding in any setting.
Any big lessons you've learned since you joined Afino in terms of how to succeed?
Yeah, I think, employees come first, right? You want your employees to be happy, and that's what really makes a successful company, having the right employees and also making sure you're helping them to succeed, right? You're not putting roadblocks in front of them. And I think that's something that we try to do here at Afino. We really try to make this an environment where everyone can succeed if they choose to do so.
Great advice, and I'm sure what makes it a great place to work. Ishmael mentioned you're on a growth trajectory, so I kind of want to get a sense of where you think that will go in 10 or 20 years. What is your dream for Afino? Kayvon, you go first, and then Ishmael.
Yeah, I can't imagine it growing much faster than we have been, right? So it was around 10 people when I started 6 years ago, and now we're pushing close to 80, right? So, that's 8 times growth in 6 years. So, but the sky's the limit, right? As far as our revenue will take us and the model will take us, I think we're willing to grow. And we have plans in place for future growth, and it's just a matter of executing to get to the point where we can sustain that growth at this point.
You want to give any preview of what those plans are?
World domination. Yeah, okay. We're trying to take over the world.
Ishmael, how about yourself?
Yeah, as an inventor, my dream was to have one of the largest technology research labs in the world. So we started with 4G and 5G, and now 6G. We added next generation Wi-Fi. We added video compression team. And then there are other technologies that we want to really tap in, semiconductor technologies. Going to AI, we already started, developing algorithms based on AI. So I wanted to have one of the largest technology labs in the world that really invents technologies that people are using every day and see the impact of those contributions. So we're going to grow at a steady pace. That's a plan, like 25% to 30% a year. That's a sustainable growth, unless we acquire other companies. And On the monetization side, I think to grow, we need to start a licensing program for the company. And that's what we are working on. And it's interesting because now some companies are approaching us and telling us, okay, they want to license our portfolio. What are our models or what are pricing information? And we hope that we can start a sustainable licensing business model that can support and provide funding for the research. So in 5 to 10 years, I would see the research lab growing, like, you know, 4 to 5 times, and also the business model switching to a sort of a light, mostly focused on licensing, bringing revenue based on licensing.
That's very interesting, and beats hoping the broker will find someone for you. So it's interesting to see that evolution in a relatively very short time. So it's amazing what you've done. So thank you so much for joining Clause 8.
Thanks, Eli. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harity & Harity LLP for their generous support. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of past episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.